And you're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 100.5 FM.
Capitalism is dependent on growth, which is how wealth is created in this society. And what drives the growth is innovation, or the creation of new products. The conventional wisdom has it that the private entrepreneur solely determines what gets created. Then the marketplace determines the success or failure of those goods. But is that what actually happens? What role do entrepreneurs play in the economy, and what role does the much maligned state play? To discuss these matters is Mariana Mazzucato. She's an economist at the University of Sussex, and she joins me on the phone this morning from London. Hello, Mariana.
Hello.
Now, in the introduction, I mentioned the conventional wisdom. According to the conventional wisdom, what role does the state play in today's economy?
Well, let's just, you know, take the extreme positions. Extreme positions are that the state is really just a nuisance, really, and that in order to have growth, we have to take away all the impediments that it creates. So reduce tax, reduce regulation. Another side proposed by people like, I don't know, Joe Stiglitz and Paul Krugman, who are proponents of the state, if you want, really focus more on the state's role in fixing all sorts of problems that occur in the market, so fixing market failures. And this second view, if you want, is one that tries to combat that first view. It's actually saying, hey, the market often screws up, as we've just seen in this massive financial crisis. But what I've been trying to argue is the state does even much more than that. It doesn't just fix markets. It actively shapes and creates them.
Well, tell us about that. What role does the state actually play?
Well, if you think about sort of, you know, innovation-led growth, which is really what capitalism is about, if you compare it to feudalism, where we had 500 years of basically inertia technologically, what is important in terms of technology is really, if you want, new technology and how that also creates new sectors. So what I've been doing is going sector by sector, so biotech, nanotech, the IT revolution, as well as the emerging clean tech revolution, and ask, well, what do we know about, you know, how these big technological revolutions come about, which then, you know, can actually create decades of growth. And what you see there is the state being actually an engine. It's not just sitting on the sidelines creating, you know, different types of regulations, which some people talk about in terms of creating the level playing field. It's actually been one of the lead engines in terms of actually investing in the really highly uncertain, high-risk areas. And the private sector only enters about, you know, 15 to 20 years after. We see this, again, sector by sector. So in biotechnology, the really difficult things that, you know, and by difficult, I mean innovation often fails. Something like 90% of R&D attempts end up with nothing. So we often don't have the right type of private finance, which is actually willing to take on that uncertainty. And in biotechnology, but also, again, in clean technology today, what the state has done has been to actually provide that patient, long-term, committed finance in the beginning, when you have these really high failure rates. And later, once, you know, there's less uncertainty, once these returns are in sight, that's when the private sector comes in. But that's not how we tell the story. So if you ask people about Silicon Valley, and in Europe, by the way, they're constantly talking about Silicon Valley, because the big question in Europe is, where are the European Googles? You know, why are all these companies like Amazon, Facebook, and Apple coming out of California? The answer that policymakers in Europe often give themselves is, oh, well, they have venture capital. That's our problem. We don't have the right kind of venture capital. And so lots of policymakers in Europe, including Canada, by the way, have been thinking about how to, you know, get this private finance, you know, business angels and VCs going without recognizing that what happened in Silicon Valley is that venture capital surfed a massive wave of state-funded investments.
So, in a sense, that the state, while in sort of injecting at those early stages funding or credits or whatever, I know that we do that here in Canada, they're absorbing some of the risk of the 90% of things that failed.
Yeah, I mean, just again, ask yourself what makes the iPhone so revolutionary and such a smartphone instead of stupid phone. What's what you can do with it? So the internet, you know, you can surf the web anywhere you are in the world, GPS, you can know where you are, touchscreen display, which makes it a really user-friendly phone, and then all these latest gadgets like the Siri voice-activated personal assistant. Well, they were all funded by the state. Then, of course, you need a very smart, genius entrepreneur like Steve Jobs to put these things in a cool way and to think of new markets for these technologies. But what people don't realize is that those technologies, which are the revolutionary bits of the iPhone, were state-funded. And so then you have the problem that we have companies like Apple and Google and Amazon, which pay very little tax. Now, so how I've talked about it is similar to what people have said about the banks, which is we've socialized the risks but privatized the rewards. Mm. So the risk is socialized in the sense that the state has taken on a massive, you know, portion of that risk, but because often these companies are not paying the tax they owe, legally, by the way, because there's all sorts of loopholes that they can take advantage of, and taxes have fallen tremendously. So capital gains tax has fallen from about 40% in the U.S. in the mid-70s to just 20% only 8 years later in the early 80s, and now it's, you know, fallen even more. And what's interesting about how it's fallen, it was actually the National Venture Capital Association which lobbied government precisely saying, we are the risk takers, we are the innovators, if you want us to invest, reduce our tax. And actually those tax reductions had no effect on their investments because that's not what's driving their investment. What's driving their investment is this perception of where the future technological and market opportunities are. And those opportunities are actually often strongly correlated with these state investments. So all those tax reductions have really created is inequality, which is one of the, you know, biggest problems we have today in modern capitalism. And so this whole issue of how to socialize not only the risks, but also the rewards is a huge challenge, I think, to make capitalism not only more innovative, because the state, by playing this very important role, needs a budget, right? And where does the state budget come from? Taxation. But also a more inclusive growth, because we don't just want innovation for innovation's sake. We want innovation because we think it's going to produce growth that is, you know, good for the population. And if growth is not inclusive, it's not good. So in Silicon Valley, the public school system has not been funded very well since the 70s, and it's currently extremely ghettoized. And this is a huge tragedy for an area which actually received a massive amount of government funding directly, and yet is not, you know, putting back money into the, you know, public system.
Which sectors of the economy benefit most from state research and development?
Well, what's interesting is the examples I gave, for example, before all these technologies behind the iPhone, it was mainly the Department of Defense through its different arms, including DARPA, which, for example, funded the Internet. But because the model was so successful, especially the DARPA model, it's currently being applied also within the Department of Energy. There is a similar agency, but it's called ARPA-E, where the E is for energy. And so in energy, there's obviously lots of spending. And again, the renewable energy portion of total investment is largely public sector spending. But also in health, the National Institutes of Health are second to the Department of Defense in terms of state budget going towards R&D. And there, what's wonderful for people like myself who, you know, I'm an economist and I do time series analysis, so I'd like to have data, is that with medicines, we actually have data on every single medicine, whether it was actually kind of a revolutionary medicine, so a new molecular entity, or if it's just a slight variation of an existing medicine. These are the Me Too drugs, so Viagra, different color, different dosage. And it turns out that close to 75% of the really radical revolutionary medicines, so the NMEs with priority rating, are actually coming out of, you know, public sector funding through these National Institutes of Health, which just last year spent $32 billion. So we're talking about big budgets. So this is a really interesting thing, that on the one hand, the U.S. is often described to us as the market model, right? And you know, Europe and sometimes even Canada is described like this, you know, has too much of a heavy state, and in order to get this innovation, we need less state, more market. But actually, it's one of the most interventionist countries in the world in terms of the innovation spending, not, for example, for the welfare spending. But anyway, and so what's also interesting, though, that it hasn't been done in a centralized way, so it's not like some big kind of Soviet-style Ministry of Innovation, top-down, deciding everything. It's been a decentralized kind of network of different state agencies, so DARPA, National Science Foundation, which, by the way, funded the algorithm behind Google, SBIR program, Small Business Innovation Research Program, which does a lot of the early-stage seed financing, the National Institutes of Health, National Nanotech Initiative, so lots of different state agencies. And this is important because innovation often, you know, occurs through kind of a trial and error, error process. There's lots of serendipity. The search for one thing, you know, leads to the discovery of something else. So actually this decentralized system is quite successful as opposed to very top-down ministerial way to do things. However, it's decentralized but very well funded. So you can't do this kind of stuff on a shoestring. And, you know, one of the real dangers today with all this kind of, you know, impasse in Congress and discussions about whether, you know, basically cutting all sorts of different parts of government without much evidence of, you know, what should be cut. It's just kind of this debate, which I think is more ideological than, if you want, scientific, that we're actually putting in danger these agencies. So the National Science Foundation, you know, it has a much lower budget now than it had before, and the pressure that's under is often, you know, to say, well, we want to see your commercial success now. And the problem with innovation is you can't. I mean, you know, when the internet was being invested in the beginning, there was, you know, huge potential for failure, but you kind of do it because you think it's important. And what this means is it's not just fixing market failures, it's more these mission-oriented investments. So putting a man on the moon was a big mission, or a woman on the moon, which led to many different sectors to interact. But again, the state, through the space agency, took the lead. The big question today, I think, for countries is, you know, what are the missions of the future? And some countries are thinking of climate change as a big mission that's required to pull together these different state agencies and different sectors to interact in a dynamic way. And there as well, we see the state playing a lead role. So if you take the entire worldwide investment in renewables and you add it up and just divide it up in terms of public versus private, the figures are astounding. So the whole private sector investment in renewable energy, which includes private venture capital, private corporate investment, and public stock market investment, in 2012 was just over $12 billion. And then just look at state investment banks. So forget, say, the Department of Energy, which in the U.S., you know, spends in this area. Just look at the public investment banks, so the China Development Bank, which is a massive player, the European Investment Bank, the KfW in Germany, and the Brazilian Development Bank. That total amount of money in renewables was $80
billion. Wow, wow.
Orders of magnitude above. And this is the new big thing, which still has huge uncertainty, and the private sector is not investing.
What do you think of the possibilities, the tale that you're telling here and the data that you're putting forward really shows that the narrative around innovation and who funds innovation and you know what causes innovation is really quite skewed in favor of you know the risk-taking entrepreneur and their angel investors and so forth. What do you think it would take to shift that narrative so that people actually understand the real story behind it that you're portraying here?
Well, first of all, I think just even getting the information out. So even just think of this whole Obamacare debate, you know, where the state was presented as a meddler in your healthcare choice. If people even just knew how much the state has done to produce those medicines, so it's not just meddling in your choices in healthcare, but it's a, you know, a lead creator in the healthcare products that you require. Just even that information. So just the data. I mean, forget then what you know, the story that one tells with those numbers. The point is those numbers are not known. People do not realize that. And again, the iPhone story, they don't know. So getting that kind of story out there, I think, is really important. And that's what I'm trying to do. And on Monday, tomorrow, no, the day after tomorrow, my TED Talk, I did a global TED Talk in Edinburgh in June, and it's coming out. And my mission with that TED Talk was really just to, you know, let people know what do we know about the iPhone? What's the story you're told in this 600-page biography of Steve Jobs? Not one page mentioned any of these investments coming from the state. It's just this, you know, great genius, which he was. And so I think just rebalancing means more people telling stories, which are, you know, I don't want to say facts, because again, with any number, you can, you know, tell a different story around that particular number. And for sure, there was also private sector investments in biotech and pharma. What we don't realize is the state is a lead risk taker. And as soon as you describe it that way, then you have to start asking about the risk return relationship. But I just read in a New Yorker, actually, sorry, in the New York Magazine, they recently just had an article about this secessionist movement in Silicon Valley. So, you know, people like P. Peter Thiel and some young entrepreneurs that he's supporting all, you know, keep talking about the state as this heavy hand, big government. We need to, you know, escape. And so there's a secessionist movement. It's just completely mad, which wants to build rafts and boats off the coast of California, so they're not going to be susceptible to, you know, taxation, and they kind of see themselves as doing this to liberate themselves from the heavy hand. And, you know, first of all, obviously a big wave comes, and they're going to be asking the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard's funded by tax money. But even besides that, the point is that that kind of narrative of, you know, we are being impeded, we have this heavy hand encumbering us of the state, is just incredibly ideological. Given, you know, what would Facebook be today without the internet on which it depends, which was, you know, 100% funded by the state? Where would Google be without its algorithm that was funded by the state? Again, all these technologies behind iPad and iPhone. So I think they would be challenged if people knew these stories, and unfortunately they don't, and so they have the sort of the upper hand, and because they seem kind of glamorous, these in theory self-made billionaires, if you start taking away the self-made part and show how much they've depended on this public sector investment, I think that would really change the debate in the U.S.
It's been wonderful and very fascinating talking to you this morning, so I really appreciate it, and we'll point people towards your TED Talk. I'm gonna look at it the first chance I get.
Great. And the book that's just come out, it's called The Entrepreneurial State, Debunking Private versus Public Sector Myths, that came out in June.
Thanks, okay. Mariana.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Mariana Mazzucato. She's an economist at the University of Sussex in England. Her latest book, The Entrepreneurial State, is available now.